morning. This is the panel on Dodd-Frank and beyond. My name is Robert Miller. I'm a professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. We have three great speakers for you. I'm going to introduce all three of them, and then in the order in which I introduce them, each speaker will talk for about 10 minutes. After that, we'll have an opportunity for the speakers to interact and to take questions from the floor. So our first speaker is the Honorable Kathleen Casey. She's a senior advisor at Potomac Global Partners and a former commissioner of the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. Professor Todd Zwicky is the George Mason Foundation Professor of Law at George Mason Law School and a senior scholar at the Mercatus Center. And Professor Deepak Gupta is a founder of Gupta Beck, PLLC, and an adjunct professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center. He's also former senior litigation counsel and senior counsel for enforcement strategy at the CFPB. So we're beginning with the Honorable Kathleen Casey.
Well, thank you very much, Robert, and pleased to join my colleagues here on the panel for what I think is a really important discussion about the increasing and reliance on independent regulators to essentially write and implement rules that we see coming out of Dodd-Frank. And I think as a result, a very necessary and heightened focus on the transparency and accountability that you have in rulemaking. If you look at Dodd-Frank, because so much new delegation of authority is provided to regulators, as well as a significant mandate for regulators to implement the law, many new rules, some 400 actually, across the agencies that were specifically anticipated by the law, makes it even more important that you have confidence in the accountability and the integrity of the rulemaking process. So Dodd-Frank itself basically underscored the importance of independence and accountability in independent agencies and rulemaking. Now the SEC, of course, has been, as an independent agency, has been subject to questions about its accountability and transparency over the years. And again, I want to talk a little bit about some of the court cases that we've seen in recent years that have called that into question and actually prompted the need for greater reform in the rulemaking process. But I do think it's really important to note that, again, just because you have so much broader grants of authority given to regulators, including the SEC, and then, again, the greater mandate for rule writing, vast rule writing across a whole range of new areas that the agency has lacked capability and capacity and expertise in the past. And then within such short order, this has put a lot of pressure on the rulemaking process. So it's actually a combination of dynamics that have led to, I think, a very important focus on the quality and integrity of rulemaking. And also, I think, underscores the importance of various structural and procedural safeguards that that have accompanied the increasing reliance on independent agencies to implement and effectuate laws like Dodd-Frank. So Congress and the courts have played very important roles in checking potential agency overreach. And I just want to highlight a couple of those and then go into some of the specifics of where we've seen the SEC be checked with respect to overreach and its processes and rulemakings, and why those are really important mechanisms as a broader matter. So you have structural safeguards. The SEC, for example, contra to the CFPB, is a commission, a board, 5 members, built-in safeguards, basically presidential appointments, Senate confirmed, staggered, set terms. No more than 3 members of the same party. Procedural safeguards, the Administrative Procedure Act, which is very important in ensuring justification for rulemaking, as well as adequate notice and comment, the transparency element. Reg Flex Act, Paperwork Reduction Act, the Federal Register Act, the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act, and, of course, the Congressional Review Act. All of these laws, all of these requirements play a really important role in ensuring the accountability of the agency's rulemaking. And then, of course, the agency has to operate by virtue of its specific or organic statutes. And there, sometimes you have specific requirements. For example, the SEC, which has actually been found to be wanting in meeting some of these requirements under the National Securities Markets Improvement Act, amended the 33 Act, the 34 Act, the Investment Company Act, to require that the Commission also consider competition and efficiency and capital formation in its rulemakings under those, pursuant to those authorities. And then again, you have oversight, general oversight, which is also really very important, whether it's the authorization process, the appropriations process, and general oversight functions. I'd also note a well-functioning IG can also be very helpful. And then, of course, I think most importantly, judicial review. Having the court's ability to review the agency's rules and actions. SEC has been in the center of Dodd-Frank implementation, a central player, I think, in driving many of the issues that we've seen be raised about concerns about overreach or the quality of rulemaking. The D.C. Circuit has been quite busy over the past 8 years, going back to a couple of rules that the agency adopted back in 2005, where they basically sought to require increased independence for mutual fund directors and mandate an independent chair. I would note about the cases that you've seen the SEC, SEC's rulemaking be questioned, remanded, or vacated, is that these are not run-of-the-mill cases. They really are outliers in the sense that you have cases that either were highly controversial, split decisions oftentimes, and again, if you look at the decisions themselves, they stand out in terms of how either the agency handled the rulemaking or if you look at the quality of the rulemaking itself. So I really do think it's important when you look at some of these decisions that you actually look at the specific context and what drove the court to find that the agency was wanting. Again, I think just to give you a sense of the mutual fund rule, which was really quite stunning, in the first decision that the court undertook, it actually remanded the case back to the agency to address two deficiencies. And within 5 days, or within a week, the agency had turned the rule around and readopted it. To express how difficult that could be for an agency to be able to do that kind of work within a week is extraordinary. And what I think it did is it started to form the basis for the court's more critical review and look at how the agency was fulfilling its obligations, not just under the APA, but under some of the specific statutes that they were applying, certainly with respect to the justification for the rule and the adequacy of the analysis. Coming off of that, you had two other cases, again, not fairly close in time, that also started to raise questions about the adequacy of the economic and cost-benefit analysis that the agency was using to support its rulemaking. And I think what you found is, again, some deference to the agency where it had the authority to act, but then did not have a sufficient basis on economic analysis to ultimately to support the decision. But I think that the real case that sort of broke the camel's back, so to say, and has really sort of focused a lot of the debate now about independent agencies and the use of cost-benefit and economic analysis and the function or the mechanism of judicial review has been the Business Roundtable case that basically struck down the agency's proxy access rule. And I think there, more than anything, it's important to note again this highly controversial rule. And if you look at the language of the court's decision, it's striking that the language that the court uses in striking down the rule shows a real palpable frustration. They go back and they cite the earlier cases that were where they found the agency wanting, and I think it demonstrates sort of over time a view by the court that the agency was just not getting it. And so I think that what you have now, certainly post the Business Roundtable ruling, are real questions, though, because this is case law now, administrative case law, real questions about what the level of scrutiny will be by the D.C. Circuit for other agency rulemakings, what kind of deference that'll provide to other agency rulemakings pursuant to Dodd-Frank, the adequacy of cost-benefit and economic analysis in that rulemaking. And because of those, because of these cases, because the SEC had been found wanting in in these cases. There's a real question now what that means for the further implementation of Dodd-Frank. The likelihood of challenge on rulemakings like the CFTC, for example, or even potentially the CFPB, and what level of deference the court will give to those judgments. I think what's also interesting to see, because of the importance of judicial review, though, is that because Dodd-Frank has now been put into question, you actually see an effort to question the credibility of the court itself. So actually questioning the motives of the court, suggesting somehow that this is politically or philosophically driven, rather than looking at the merits of the particular cases that were before the court. And I think so that assault on the court itself has also been accompanied by an assault now on the discipline of cost-benefit analysis, because it's being viewed as essentially an obstacle to Dodd-Frank implementation. And I think this is really an extraordinary view. One, because it's interesting that the CFPB, for proponents of the CFPB, many of them are hanging their hat on accountability by virtue of saying, well, they do cost-benefit analysis and economic analysis. And then at the same time, the same proponents are criticizing the SEC and other agencies for pursuing that discipline and making that an important part of their rulemaking under Dodd-Frank. So I think that it also speaks to a broader view of the notion of independence of regulators, which is sort of this sort of more technocratic view that regulators should be somehow isolated or inoculated from certain outside pressures. And that, again, cost benefit is somehow a tool that these interests are using to prevent Dodd-Frank's pure goals from being achieved. And I think that's a real mistake, because again, it is a longstanding discipline in federal rulemaking. It's an important accountability mechanism, and it actually ensures at the end of the day that these rules are going to be effective, because you actually know what the costs and the benefits are, and then at the end of the day whether or not those benefits are likely to surpass the costs. So it is a really important mechanism. I think there are some parallels here to the CFPB. The SEC does not have the same structural deficiencies to some degree in terms of the protections that are built in. But I do think that the judicial review component and the deference that the court gives to agency rulemakings is particularly relevant. And then also, I think more fundamentally, the question of whether or not agencies continue to have the same kind of oversight that they have received from Congress is also an important element, and that goes to appropriations, for example, and the fact that the SEC also has that mechanism for ensuring that the agency is fulfilling its mission and not overreaching. So with that, I will queue up that topic and then leave to Todd.
Mr. Zawicki.
Thanks, Kathleen. It's a privilege for me to appear here with Kathleen and Deepak. And Deepak and I are basically going to go back and forth on CFPB. So I guess I'll give the con case before he gives the pro case for CFPB. And I want to say at the outset, I actually agreed with the proposition that that there was problems with the way the consumer financial protection was executed on the federal level, which is the fragmentation of consumer financial protection among many different agencies, I think was a problem. It was like a United Nations meeting every time you tried to do something. So I actually supported the idea of centralizing consumer financial protection in one location. That location should have been the Federal Trade Commission. There was no reason to create the CFPB, and there was certainly no reason to create it the way we did. But I agreed with the proposition. There's also no evidence that consumer protection problems was a significant cause of the financial crisis, as opposed to other things, which we'll come back to later, which are really safety and soundness problems. What's the problem with the CFPB? And what I'm going to talk about is very briefly talk about the structure, and then talk about how the structural defects are manifesting themselves in practice, because we have 30 years of study of regulation to know how the CFPB is going to go off the rails, and it's going off the rails exactly the way that scholars who have studied the theory of regulation for 30 years would have predicted, and the way American history has unfolded. In many ways, I think of it as the revenge of Richard Nixon. The structure of the CFPB is like some bureaucratic structure frozen in ice in the 70s, put in cold storage, kind of missed the whole public choice and innovation revolution, thawed back out as if it didn't learn anything at all from what went awry. And what did go awry? Well, in the 70s, what we know is that the economy went in the tank in the 70s, partly because we had a very poor regulatory structure, which is we had a bunch of unaccountable bureaucracies subject to regulatory capture, no coherent feedback mechanism, poor oversight from Congress, and the end result was a huge regulatory tax on the economy, and we've come to understand why that came about. And so we have two ways in which we do regulatory agencies. We've got executive agencies, which are accountable to the president, and the president takes the blame or the credit for what they do. And then we've got independent agencies, which have this particular structure of being bipartisan agencies subject to active congressional oversight and congressional appropriations and that sort of thing. CFPB is neither. CFPB, to refresh your memory, has a single director appointed for a five-year term, removable only for cause, subject, in theory, to confirmation by the United States Senate. But as we know, even that little shred of accountability to the Congress was end-run in the effort to appoint the director of the CFPB through a so-called recess appointment. And just to make clear, when I mention Richard Cordray, I'm not going to refer to him as Director Cordray. He is not the director of the CFPB. He is no more the director of the CFPB than he is the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He simply is not the director of the CFPB, and I don't think there's any real serious argument that that was a valid recess appointment, which we can come back to. So we have these two different models, and there's reason why we have that model. Accountability on one hand, deliberation and good policy on the other hand is the idea of bipartisan agency structure. So how is this manifesting itself in practice at the CFPB? The CFPB claims that it should not be subject to, one last thing is CFPB's budget is basically guaranteed. The CFPB is essentially an independent agency inside of another independent agency. It is a bureau of the Fed, but it's not accountable to the Fed. All the Fed does is send it money, huge, gushing, gushers of money with basically no accountability. And it's not accountable to Congress because Congress can have these little dog and pony shows, but it doesn't really have the stick of appropriations to keep it in line. And this is having effects. So let's talk about a couple of examples. The qualified mortgages rule, the auto dealer bulletin that it sent out, and very briefly, its credit card complaint database. I want to focus on the qualified mortgages rule because this is kind of the big kahuna of what they've done. Now, the argument of the CFPB, as I understand, is that they don't have to be subject to the standard accountability and oversight mechanisms because they're engaged in so-called evidence-based policymaking, that they're just looking at the data and they're like little engineers and scientists looking at the data. Well, that's absurd, right? They don't look at the data any more than, say, the Federal Trade Commission does, the Securities and Exchange Commission, or anybody else does, right? And it is all the data in the economic studies are always subject to policy and political interpretations. The data don't tell you stories. You have to interpret the data. You have to ask what you're going to ask about the data. You have to interpret the studies. And on this, if you look at the qualified mortgages rule, for instance, it's actually kind of frightening how the CFPB believes and how it uses the studies and the data that it has behind it. So if I had a PowerPoint, you really kind of got to read this to get the whole effect of it. And I brought a PowerPoint, but we don't have a screen. So I'm going to read to you one particular passage in the qualified mortgage rule, which has to do with so-called complex mortgages, which are basically negative amortization mortgages. Now, there's been one economic study done on the effect of negative amortization mortgages, right, where people didn't even pay the interest, and so their mortgages, the balance rose over time, right? These were incredibly stupid mortgages for lenders to make. These were incredibly smart mortgages for consumers to take, and consumers have done exactly what you would expect, which is once their houses went down in value, they've walked away from these mortgages, right? So One study has been done on this to ask, were these mortgages predatory, these complex mortgages? Well, here's what the study says, the one study that the CFPB relies on. Quote, "We find that complex mortgages are used by households with high income levels and prime credit scores in contrast to the low income population targeted by subprime mortgages. Our analysis of dynamic default patterns, bankruptcy filings, and household characteristics suggests that complex mortgage contracts attract sophisticated borrowers who are more strategic in their default decisions." High income, high credit score borrowers, why do they have such high foreclosure rates? Because when their houses went down in value, they said, this is a terrible investment, and they walked away, right? How does the CFPB interpret this in banning negative amortization on mortgages? In their later incarnations, interest-only negative amortizing mortgages were often sold on the basis of the consumer's ability to afford the initial payments and without regard to the consumer's ability to afford subsequent payments once the rate was recast. The lower payment possibility for these loans allows borrowers to qualify for loans that they otherwise might not have been able to afford, but this comes with some risk just described. The performance of many of these loans was also very poor and worse than expected with the onset of the downturn, citing the study I just quoted. It says the final rule doesn't ban such products outright, but requires that the lenders that make such loans have reasonable good faith belief in the borrower's ability to repay, and that if formulating such a belief, the lender must calculate the monthly payment based on the fully indexed rate and fully amortizing payments, right? Somehow or another, the quintessential study of strategic default on by high-income, high-credit-score borrowers went through the CFPB process and came out as something about the ability of borrowers to repay, right? That's the only evidence that we have on this. Policy-based evidence-making? Evidence-based policy-making? Which might it be? They also go after teaser rates. I could elaborate this as well. The CFPB admits that teaser rates, that there's really no evidence to support teaser rates being a problem, yet those are banned as well. The other thing we see at the CFPB is this inability to sort of distinguish when consumers are acting rationally from a consumer protection problem. Qualified mortgages give another good example, which is the problem, what caused the foreclosure problem, was not payment shocks, it was not teaser rates, it wasn't anything that. What caused the foreclosure problems in this country was the deterioration of down payment requirements and cash out refinances, right? The reason why foreclosure rates went up so high was because housing prices fell. Some people, yes, had payment shock problems, but we all know the primary reason why foreclosures got so high was because housing prices fell, people crunched the numbers, they decided it was a bad investment. If you take, for example, California, which has an anti-deficiency law, or Arizona, which has an anti-deficiency law, which means the bank can only take the house back, they can't sue you for a deficiency. Foreclosure rates, we know from economic studies, are 2 to 3 times higher in states that have anti-deficiency laws when housing prices fall. Nothing in the QM rule, however, addresses the problem of down payments and the like. They treat the whole problem as an ability to pay problem. The second issue I want to, what's the takeaway from QM? The takeaway from QM is how they end up doing it is they basically use the qualified mortgages rule and says if you make these loans that have certain characteristics, you get a safe harbor for those. If you make something outside of those, then you take your chances, right? You get a safe harbor from for consumer protection, not from equal credit, as we'll talk about in a second. Why is that important? Because you may remember when Dodd-Frank was originally introduced, there was this ludicrous concept of plain vanilla loan products. Does anybody remember this? And it kind of became sort of comical in town, and it doesn't make any sense. And it was one of the first things that was dropped out, and Congress said, we don't want it in there. What does the QM rule do? It doesn't say you must offer the so-called plain vanilla mortgage, the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. What it says is if you do offer that, you get this safe harbor. If you offer something else, you're taking your life in your hands, right? Is that, it seems to me, they're just imposing plain vanilla through the back door, dampening the innovation, exactly what Congress was concerned about. Second thing I want to turn to, and I'll finish on this, has to deal with a new missive, which has to do with auto dealers. in the effort of CFPB through a bulletin, basically they're going to make captive lenders and other providers of financing to auto dealers responsible for any racial disparities that are believed to be due to discrimination by the auto dealers when they make a loan. So I don't know if you know how this works, but when you buy a car, you go into the auto dealer's office, and they start talking about financing, right? And what they do is they're kind of like a mortgage broker, which is they basically take your credit information, send out a request for proposals. People say, we'll lend to Zawicki, you know, they never wrote my name, I don't think, but we'll lend to this dude at 4% or whatever, right? And Kathleen sends a bid, say, we'll take it at four and a quarter, right, or whatever the case may be, right? Those people who are lending never see the consumer, right? They never see the consumer. They don't know who the consumer is. They just know what their credit score is. They're not sitting across the desk from them. They don't know whether they're white or black or Hispanic or whatever the case may be, right? Nonetheless, they're going to make those guys responsible for the lending patterns of the dealers. Now, why is this a problem? Well, number one, it shows absolutely no understanding of the industry, right? Which is there's a lot of reasons why there's disparity in financing prices, which is it may be that the auto dealer is trying to move pickup trucks in Dallas, right? Because he's got too much surplus. So they're giving lower rates for certain cars that just happen to be bought by different people, right? Number one. Number two, when CFPB issued this bulletin, they never kind of told them what was going to be the threshold, how they were going to measure it, how any of those things are going to happen. Number three, talk about cost-benefit analysis. Why would they do this in this sort of vague sort of, we're thinking about suing you for equal credit? Well, because otherwise they'd have to do a rulemaking, and rulemaking would be subject to transparency, would be subject to cost-benefit analysis, that sort of thing, right? So they're going to use kind of the threat of enforcement to basically get these guys to do their dirty work on the dealers. But there's a fourth thing that I think is of particular interest here as it relates to Congress, which is the auto dealers are an incredibly impressive lobbying force. They got themselves a carve-out from Dodd-Frank. I don't know if you know that. Pure special interest carve-out. But it's pretty clear. Section 1029, exclusion for auto dealers, is Section 1029 of Dodd-Frank. It's pretty clear that CFPB is not supposed to regulate auto dealers when they issue credit. What is this? It's basically an effort to regulate auto dealers when they issue credit by using the intermediary of those who are providing credit to the auto dealers, right? Again, it's just like the imposition of plain vanilla through the back door. So what's the bottom line here? I think that what we're seeing is that the unaccountability and the defective agency structure of the CFPB is manifesting itself in exactly the way we would expect. Agency overreach, the lack of deliberation and the like within the agency is causing defective use of economic data, for instance. That wouldn't happen at the FTC. That misconstruction of the complex mortgages study, the way the CFPB does, would not happen at the FTC because there would be an internal deliberative process where other commissioners would be there to blow the whistle on those who would inadvertently misinterpret a study like that. That's why I think the proposals that are on the table for how CFPB should be reformed, subject to budgetary appropriations, a bipartisan commission structure, and some of the other oversight things, I think are exactly what are needed to make this agency effective. Thanks.
Professor Gupta. Wow. So Todd is not a fan of the CFPB, and it's appropriate that I'm sitting to his left. I am a fan of the CFPB. I'm an alum of the CFPB, and before I joined the agency, I was with the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen and worked on some aspects of the legislation, particularly Title 10 of Dodd-Frank, that led to the creation of the CFPB. So I am a fan. I think it's important to step back. This is an issue that's become very politicized in Washington, and that's unfortunate because the CFPB is an attempt to respond to a very real crisis that occurred. It's a crisis that almost crippled the American economy, but it also has enormous impacts on people, on the most vulnerable people in society. We're talking about an epic foreclosure crisis that has resulted and is continuing to result in millions of foreclosures. The numbers really have to be compared to things like wars and mass displacements when you think about the real impact on American consumers. And so Todd said there's no evidence that that consumer protection problems caused the financial crisis. We could have a whole other debate about that. I really beg to differ. But I don't think there's any debate that there were real consumer protection problems with real impacts on Americans, and that was in large part a result of regulatory failure. And I guess we agree on this to some degree as well. The regime before the CFPB was created was very fragmentary. You had 10 agencies with overlapping responsibilities that none of whom really, with the exception of the FTC, which had very limited authority with respect to financial products, none of whom had consumer protection as their primary mission, right? Their primary mission was the safety and soundness of financial institutions, which really just means the profitability of financial institutions. So that was their primary mission, and their secondary mission, sometimes their, you know, the third tier mission, was consumer protection, and it really took a back seat. So we can't talk about the CFPB without recognizing that regulatory failure is real, and that was itself a result of a set of bureaucratic pathologies that the legislation was designed to address. So what I want to do is say a little bit about why I think we needed the CFPB and why it's starting to fulfill its promises. To the extent that it is insulated to some degree, why that's a good thing, and then actually why I think the CFPB is not the unaccountable Frankenstein's monster that it's been portrayed as, but is actually in some ways more accountable than any other agency in Washington. There are unique accountability measurements that only apply to the CFPB. So first, let's look at what the system looked like before the CFPB was created. You had, I think the prime example of this is the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. You had a banking agency, and this is true of several of these prudential regulators, that derived their funding not from Congress. So like the CFPB, they're not getting their appropriations from Congress. They're completely insulated from the appropriations process. But they're getting it from an even worse place than this gusher of funds from the Federal Reserve Board. They're getting it from assessments on the banks, whom they regard as their clients, at banks that have the opportunity to change their regulatory charter and seek a different regulator if they don't like what that regulator is doing. That is a crazy system, and it does not work. It leads to the example you have with the OCC is massive preemption of state consumer protection regulations just at the time that the mortgage crisis could have been prevented through state law. The OCC was investing a lot of its energy in preempting that regulation. And it did so because that was an advantage to its clients who were funding the agency and who could go to another regulator if they weren't getting the preemption they wanted. And so you had regulators like the Office of Thrift Supervision, which has thankfully been abolished by Dodd-Frank, competing with the OCC and with other regulators to offer the most preemption, the most sort of the biggest deregulatory shield that they could offer. And that had very real consequences. So you had not just a failure to do anything about the crisis when it could have been prevented, and the Federal Reserve Board had that authority, the OCC had that authority, the OTS had that authority, but also taking steps that actually created a shield against regulators at the state level and other federal regulators that were trying to do something about the causes that led to the crisis. So we can't look at the CFPB without thinking about it in those terms. Now, what bureaucratic pathology is the CFPB most trying to avoid? It's the pathology of agency capture, and Todd mentioned that. I think we both agree that capture is something we want to avoid, and there is an emerging scholarship now about agency design, but I think it's just really nascent. People have not really thought very carefully about how you create an agency, how you should create an agency, and what consequences come from agency design. So it's true, we really have two models. We have sort of the model of the founding fathers, which was there was one person. You knew who that person was accountable for what a cabinet department did. And then you have the progressive era, New Deal era model of a multi-member commission that's subject to all sorts of problems, gridlock, a lack of accountability because there's not one person for whom the buck stops there. And for a long time, those were the only two models. I think the CFPB is the first agency that actually is informed by scholarship about agency capture and about agency design and is intended to try to avoid those problems. So as Todd mentioned, it is true. It's inside the Federal Reserve Board. But you do have a director, a single director that's accountable and is removable by cause by the president, which is true of all the other prudential regulators. It's true that it's insulated from appropriations, but so are all the financial prudential regulators. The difference here is that the funding isn't coming from the very people who are supposed to be regulated. And then you've got the one thing that applies only to the CFPB and not to any other regulators, which is that the Financial Stability Oversight Council, created by Dodd-Frank Act to take into account systemic risk in the economy, actually has the ability to veto anything that the CFP does. And so the other regulators can actually gang up on the CFPB and vote to veto any rulemaking by the CFPB. That is totally unprecedented. No other agency in Washington is subject to the veto of other agencies. So I would argue that actually the CFPB is more accountable than any other agency because of that veto power. And there are actually proposals to beef up the veto power, to make it a two-thirds a simple majority rather than just a supermajority, which is what the current legislation provides for. So that's actually a lot of accountability. And so I would say that, you know, the CFPB is quite accountable. It's also, you know, Director Cordray has been on the Hill for hearings more than any other agency director I can recall, except maybe the IRS folks recently. And that's because congressional accountability really does matter. And I can say that firsthand. I can sort of testify here that we really did care what people on the Hill thought about what we were doing and were quite careful. I think it's a bit of a straw man to say that the agency's defenders are defending the agency on the grounds that, well, we look at the evidence and it's an empirically based agency, and so accountability it doesn't really matter because we're following the evidence. That's a silly argument. I agree with that, and I don't think that the defenders of the CFPB are primarily saying that. Because any agency could say that, and ultimately, regulatory products that are going to have to be tested. They're going to be subject to the same kinds of review in the D.C. Circuit that the SEC's rules are subject to that Kathleen mentioned. We haven't seen that yet. The CFPB is sort of even before the agency opened its doors, even before it did anything, the agency was criticized as this unaccountable rogue regulator. Let's actually wait for the agency to produce final rules before we attack them as being unaccountable. The agency hasn't produced a single set of final rules that have gone through the entire process and been tested in the courts. And I think then we'll see whether a lot of this rhetoric is true. But it has been exaggerated, has been politicized, and that's unfortunate. And a lot of that has to do with the debate when the CFPB was being considered in Congress, and you had Elizabeth Warren, who was sort of a lightning rod, and in effect was running a political campaign. I think the temperature has dialed down now that Rich Cordray is at the helm. And I talked to a lot of industry lawyers about the CFPB. I'm not familiar enough with that particular Boston Fed study that Todd mentioned to defend this one little piece of this incredibly complex and large rulemaking that the CFPB is undertaking. But what I'm hearing from industry lawyers is quite different, that they're actually pleasantly surprised that the agency is not a bunch of cowboys on the Elizabeth Warren mold, but it's actually composed of lots of people with deep industry experience, a lot of people from a variety of different sectors, and it's creating a unique culture. I feel very privileged to have worked there because the talent level at that agency is off the charts. There are people from academia, from industry, from consumer protection groups, from the state and federal regulators that are producing a unique agency culture. And, you know, I am concerned. I'm concerned about whether the Bureau is going to give in to the kinds of bureaucratic pathologies that we've seen in other agencies. But what I'm concerned about is whether or not this agency is going to be captured by industry in the same way that all the other financial regulators have been captured, or whether we've designed this agency in such a way that it's insulated going forward.
So thank you to the panelists. I'll now let them interact a little bit if they want to respond to each other.
Yeah, no, I think it, you raise an interesting point about how it's too early to know how the agency will be tested because you haven't had any final rulemakings. And I think that actually raises a concern, and one that won't be just unique to the CFPB, but also for other agencies who, you know, worry about their rules being challenged in the courts, and the ability of agencies to use guidance or, as Todd mentioned, enforcement actions or compliance functions to achieve the same objective without going through the more formal public process. And I do think that's a risk. So I'd be curious what you think about the risk of that at the CFPB, because there's a shyness, and it's a natural one on the part of, you know, it's an institutional bias as much as a natural tendency for institutions to want to be successful in achieving their objectives, certainly when it's, I think we've seen some of the more controversial rules, not likely to be popular and likely to be challenged in the courts. So I don't know what, I'd be curious what my colleagues think about the risk of that and how existing protections or existing mechanisms exist to ensure that that doesn't happen.
Well, I mean, I think the CFPB is very conscious of that risk and has actually put in place a bunch of processes to try to prevent, you know, when you hire a bunch of enforcement lawyers, they're going to see, they have a hammer and they're likely to see every problem as a nail. And a lot of enforcement agencies function that way. So the state attorneys general's offices, they don't typically ask, well, is this a problem that would be better solved through regulation or should we enforce? But the CFPB, because it has a bunch of different kinds of tools in its toolbox, tries to be very careful about making sure that the right tool is selected. And just because somebody has identified a case that could be brought, that case isn't necessarily brought. And so, you know, if you look at the enforcement actions that have been brought so far, there haven't been a whole lot of them. And most of them have resulted in settlements with major industry players that are not very controversial, actually. I think the first thing that the agency has done that's really controversial in the enforcement space is this auto bulletin. But even that, I don't see what all the fuss is about, because these racial disparities in auto lending have been known for a very long time. Ian Ayers did a famous study a long time ago that pointed out the enormous racial disparities that exist in the auto finance area. And those disparities haven't gone away. They went away. There was a settlement or a series of class action settlements, that the relief of which has now expired. And those problems are still here. So they're not new. And they really are structural. They're caused by the compensation systems with the lenders that result in a lot of discretion. That discretion can be eliminated quite easily by changing the compensation system. And so the Bureau is telegraphing, here's something we're looking at. You may want to consider changing the compensation structure. If you do that, you won't have any fair lending liability. You can also institute compliance programs to make sure that there's no fair lending consequences of your lending. But it's true. It's not writing a rule, and I think there's a legitimate debate about whether or not the Bureau is using the right tools for any given subject matter.
I'll just say a few words first on that. It is not the case that that's been established, number one, and it's clearly not the case that it's ever been established that the compensation scheme would be what would drive racial disparities. In the bulletin, it's kind of embarrassing what they say in the bulletin, which is there is discretion, and that discretion could be misused, right, is basically what they say. So as a result, we've got to change the entire structure of this industry, which is pretty amazing. I mean, it's like they've never thought about maybe it's a two-tail distribution, right? Maybe people go to get their financing from the auto dealer. Some of them get lower rates. Some of them get higher rates, right? You got that problem. You got a second problem, and it's shown in the qualified mortgages rule, which is one of the beauties of the CFPB is that they do both consumer protection and equal credit. So basically what that means is they can sue you for lending or not lending to exactly the same person, right? So you could make loans that are fit the qualified mortgage rule and be protected from consumer protection. But if it turns out, for instance, there are racial disparities, say, in average FICO scores, you may end up with a pool that meets the consumer protection standards, right, of being all safe mortgages, but fails the equal credit standards, right? And in which case, then you've got that problem. So one last thing, picking up on something Deepak said, which is, I am very concerned about industry capture here, and in particular, I think it's an overstatement to talk about the industry, right? Mm-hmm. There are really two industries. There are the big banks, who are perfectly happy with CFPB. Bank of America signed on very early to the idea of CFPB, and the big banks are fine with it. Why? Because CFPB is going to promote, along with the rest of Dodd-Frank, promote consolidation of the banking industry. The regulatory cost of complying with Dodd-Frank, the entrenchment of the too big to fail subsidy, everything else is basically accelerating consolidation of the banking industry. And the big banks, it is a rounding error for Citibank to hire 100 lawyers to deal with the CFPB. If you're some community bank and you've got to add another lawyer to deal with CFPB, or if you're some small payday lender and medium-sized payday lender, there are huge regulatory costs that are coming from. So when you talk about the industry, what they talk about are the big banks, and the big banks like CFPB, because CFPB has given them a competitive advantage. Same thing with the qualified mortgages rule. The more you turn mortgages into commodities, the more that benefits the big banks. So I think capture is a real problem here, and it's captured by the big banks at the expense of the rest of the industry, and consumers lose from that.
So two things in response. I mean, first, I think the agency is very conscious of the risk that you can be subject to liability for not lending and then subject to liability for racial discrimination. But I think that the fair lending enforcement has sort of shifted, and so that in the 70s, the concern was that people weren't getting enough access to credit. Now the real concern is the opposite. It's the pendulum is swung, and the concern is predatory products that are being specifically targeted at minorities. And so I think that tension, while it's a real tension, it's one the Bureau is concerned about, is not likely to manifest itself. The second thing I would say is the Bureau is very concerned about taking measures that are going to favor larger players in the industry over smaller players in the industry. It's one of the reasons for the Bureau's existence, is that rather than have all these different regulators that deal with different financial institutions based on their size, you have a level playing field where the same rules are being applied across the board. Now, I guess I'm not that concerned about the compliance costs for payday lenders. That's, I guess, a separate debate. But you know, that's a product that we could probably do without entirely. But the Bureau is very concerned about compliance costs for small banks, and I think the small banks were actually among the biggest supporters of the legislation. The community banks were big supporters of the legislation and the CFPB in its early years, and I think that's because they recognize that the Bureau has the capability of leveling the playing field.
At this point, I'd like to open the floor for questions. If you are recognized, please ask a question. If you attempt to make a speech, I will cut you off and turn it back to the panelists. Sir?
No, we have a mic.
Okay, so the microphone is over there on your left. Questions? Well, in that case, I will exercise the moderator's privilege and have a question really directed to the panelists generally.
I didn't say anything controversial, apparently.
what a disappointment. If it goes to cost-benefit analysis, I think everyone agrees that regulation should be efficient, and the way you determine whether it's efficient is to do the cost-benefit analysis. But one of the problems with the CBA is that doing a prospective analysis of whether or not a regulation is efficient is a very uncertain thing. So if an agency wanted to make a regulation look efficient, it could, by trying hard enough, produce an analysis that makes it look efficient. And if a court adopts a very deferential attitude towards that analysis, it will inevitably end up rubber stamping the analysis, and everything will pass cost-benefit analysis. On the other hand, if the court decides to pick holes in an analysis, no matter how good it may actually be, the court could succeed in showing that the analysis really isn't convincing. So how do we deal with that problem? Assuming that the agency is going to behave badly, if you're a cynic like me, what should the court's attitude towards the analysis produced by an agency really be? How do you balance being too critical so that you can strike down anything you want and being too deferential to let the agency get away with whatever it pleases?
Well, I'll start again. Just, you know, going back historically, I think that there has been a fair amount of deference that the court has provided to agency judgments. And you actually have a standards that have been developed over the years with respect to the reasonableness of the judgments that the agency takes. You also have a body of law with respect to, you know, the addressing whether or not there are violations of the Administrative Procedure Act, or whether or not you have whether or not there's been a sufficient justification for the rule in the first instance, whether as well as the adequacy of the of cost-benefit analysis. And I think that what's important there is what is the origin of the requirement, right? So whether or not it's a specific requirement. So as I mentioned earlier, for the SEC, they've got specific statutory requirements with respect to considering the impact on competition and efficiency and capital formation. You also have specific requirements that speak to considering alternatives that are least burdensome on smaller entities, for example, whether or not that has been adequately considered. I think, though, if you look at some of the court cases, and this gets to, well, first off, recognizing that cost-benefit analysis is really not, it's not a precise science. Mm-hmm. You have both quantitative and qualitative elements. I think where you've seen the agency fail miserably in the past, if you look at some of the court cases I mentioned earlier, Chamber 1 and Chamber 2, less so American Equity, certainly Business Roundtable, you had efforts, you had the agency completely abdicating its obligation to even hazard a guess on costs. So basically under when it was adopting the mutual fund rule, it didn't even bother to say, we don't know what their unknowable costs, and so we can't even bother to estimate them. The court said, you know what, that's a line in the sand we're willing to make, which is you got to at least try. So it's not that you were even dealing there with sort of the nuances of, you know, trying to really take a disagreeing with the analysis that the agency has. I think a couple of other examples that you see, and this would be in the proxy access rule, which I think, again, is well worth anybody's time if they want to look at sort of a litany of deficiencies that were recognized in the process there, is you had inconsistent use of data. So when it was favorable to use it one way, the agency would use it to justify the cause. And when the data, the very same data was used in the contrary position, when it helped the agency's objective. So inconsistent use of the same data sets. Or the other would be not looking at all of the data in a more balanced way, so being very dismissive of other data or other comments that were provided for the record. I think that those were some of the primary concerns that just were sort of glaring with respect to the deficiency in some of these rules. I think, though, just to, before I let my other folks talk, I think one thing that I think is going to be challenging, though, is a lot of folks now looking at the level of scrutiny that the court has been taking to agency actions, again, particularly with the SEC, we'll see with the CFTC ultimately, is this focus now on qualitative, right? So because quantitative might not look so good when it's, you know, several billion dollars to implement a rule, you have folks now are arguing, well, you need to look at things holistically. So you need to look at, like, the entire cost of the crisis was umpteen billion dollars. Therefore, fill in the blank, this rule is justified. I'm begging the question of the nexus between, you know, whether or not that rule would actually contribute, or whether that rule would have actually contributed to the crisis. I think that this focus now on qualitative analysis is important, but I think that it's not to the exclusion of quantitative analysis. And I do think that you're seeing this effort to sort of change the terms of debate with cost-benefit analysis, because there are people that are worried that that somehow cost-benefit is now going to be an impediment to achieving, you know, the greater good. Although I don't know how you can determine the greater good if you don't know in the first instance whether or not the benefits are likely to be achievable, which is the value of cost-benefit analysis in the first instance as a discipline.
Well, I mean, you know, these questions are very, very hard. And I think maybe it's just a question of degree where you come down, because I think we can probably all agree that if an agency is really using the same evidence inconsistently, or not even making any attempt to comply with an obligation to measure benefits versus costs, then there's something wrong there. But I'm very concerned that cost-benefit analysis is now being used as a disguised form of just kind of second-guessing rulemaking in the first instance. And you imagine as a thought experiment that we imposed on Congress an obligation to measure the benefits and costs of any proposed legislation, to explain how it had done so, and then allow the courts to invalidate any legislation on that basis. Wow, there would never be any legislation. And maybe some of us think that's a good thing, but that would be a really radical shift in our system. So I'm very troubled that cost benefit is often just an argument to do nothing. When I read the Business Roundtable case from the D.C. Circuit, I read it and I picture a D.C. Circuit judge sitting in an armchair looking at some of the studies that the SEC relied on and saying, well, I don't find that sufficiently persuasive. And that actually is a line in the opinion. That's not the standard of review, I think, that the APA contemplates for judicial review of agency action. It really is the court, one unelected branch, substituting itself for another set of unelected regulators. But at least those regulators are exercising authority delegated to them by Congress. And, you know, if Congress doesn't like what they've done, they can always withdraw the authority or write a statute that changes the result. So I'm very troubled by what's happening in the D.C. Circuit, and I'm afraid about what happens when the CFPB's rules finally face that test.
I'll just say two quick things. The one I'm familiar with, I was speaking to a gathering a little while back of the debt collectors who are subject to this large participants thing. And I read to them the CFPB's estimates of how long it would take the larger actors to deal with examination. And literally the room erupted in laughter because some of it actually already been through the CFPB process. And it bore no resemblance to what CFPB's made-up numbers CFPB said about what the time was going to be and that sort of thing. But the second thing, and Robert touched on two options. Option number three is to just do what the CFPB is doing with the auto thing, right? Which is just evade cost benefit completely. Remake the entire compensation scheme of the way that auto loans have been done for 70 years, since 80 years, 100 years since GMAC was created. The unintended consequences of that, you know, all the possible ramifications from that, they're going to just do by telling the people who give them money to basically privately regulate them. Emperor Cordray has also said that abusive, you know, the big thing is, you know, unfair, deceptive, and abusive. They're not going to do a rulemaking on abusive. Abusive is going to be something that's done through enforcement after the fact. There's no cost benefit analysis involved there, so you can just end run the whole thing if you don't think it will pass a cost benefit scrutiny.
Question from the gentleman at the mic.
Todd, you touched on the fact that the when you have the same regulations applying to the big banks and the small community banks, it's encouraging consolidation. I'm wondering what you or Deepak perhaps would have to say about a different effect that we hear about on Capitol Hill, which is that there are banks that were never engaged in these particular practices, yep. Particularly the large regional banks were never engaged in these practices, and they are now no longer able to make loans that they were able to make before because of the new regulations, when these loans that they were able to make before never defaulted. And they are extremely frustrated with their inability to continue the same perfectly legitimate and profitable and non-defaulted loan practices that they were practicing before all of this happened.
I'm not going to defend that.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add. I mean, I think that's exactly the problem that you see. It's just it's The QM rule is just a huge, massive sort of overlay of regulation that wouldn't have. That's what's funny about it. It wouldn't have prevented the crisis. The problem on the crisis was that the banks made these stupid loans with no down payment, right? So when people's houses fell in value, they went into negative equity and people walked away. There's nothing in QM that stops that. It's all this other stuff that may have had an effect here and there. And so people who made prudent loans that didn't run down the what the down payment expectations were and that sort of thing, didn't cause a problem, and now they've got this huge regulatory overlay on top of them. So I agree completely. And the other thing that the QM rule does, or that Dodd-Frank does, it has special protections before people lose their right to claim their anti-deficiency laws, which maybe that's a good idea, maybe it's a bad idea, but it is something that increases foreclosures because it basically turns people's mortgage into an option, whether they pay or not. And so that's why the empirical evidence shows if you got one of these laws, people walk away from their homes when they're underwater, right? So there are actually things in Dodd-Frank and the CFPB is doing that because they treat everything as a consumer protection problem, when really it's people rationally responding to incentives, right? If I give you a loan with nothing down and your house goes down in value, you're in an anti-deficiency state and you decide to walk away from that mortgage, that's the best investment you're gonna ever make in your life, right? Perfectly rational, right? When people rationally respond to incentives, that is not a consumer protection problem. If you treat people as these hapless saps who have been rolled by the banking industry, when in fact they understand the incentives they're doing, you're creating a new set of incentives, you're basically seeding new levels of moral hazard without addressing the old problems. And that's what a lot of these unintended consequences are.
We are out of time. Please join me in thanking our panelists.